Hi, I'm Caitlin, a podcast producer here at C-SPAN. This week on Lectures in History podcast, a lecture on historically black colleges and universities student activism. North Carolina Central University history professor Jasmine Howard discusses student activism and the civil rights movement.
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach. So no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So this is History 3520, African-American history since 1865. We're at North Carolina Central University. And today I'll be lecturing about HBCU activism in North Carolina. Okay. So at first, I'm going to give you the main takeaways of this lecture. It's going to be like 5 or 6, and then we'll get into the actual examples of it. So historically black college and universities were important movement spaces for the long black freedom movement. So they were kind of essential to the civil rights movement and black power movement. Black student activists continuously used the campus space to mobilize for freedom on their campuses and surrounding communities. And in doing so, they transformed their local campuses, communities, North Carolina and elsewhere. Typically, when we learn about HBCU activism in North Carolina, there's a focus on the Greensboro Four, on 1960, but kind of everything else, right, gets left out, right? So this lecture is about the decades of activism that predates 1960 and the decades of activism, HBCU activism, that after 1960. So putting those into context and not just talking about A&T, right? Some other takeaways is think about the different strategies utilized to end segregation, right? There's just not just one strategy, right? We've already talked about lawsuits. We've talked about marches, direct action, right? We talked about advocacy, using newspapers and writings, self-defense, right? So we're just thinking about those different strategies and how they're used in the HBCU context. This is a point that I've talked about a lot. The laws and the legal system were important, but application and enforcement matters, right? Because, you know, we already talked about how the 13th, the 14th, the 15th Amendments were still in the books, right, when the Black Nadir happens, right? Those laws are still in the books, but they weren't enforced, right, and allowed for segregation to go throughout the land, right? So, again, enforcement matters, right? And largely part, when it comes to segregation, enforcement is through policy, culture, and the use of violence. Right. The struggle for desegregation occurred in K-12 and higher education institutions. and children and others sacrificed in order for desegregation to occur, right? So usually we'll talk about children, youth, in terms of the civil rights movement and Black Power movement, but we don't see them as activists in their own right, right? You hear about the Brown versus Board of Education students, but we don't think about the actual children, right, who had to desegregate or try to desegregate schools, right? We think about Thurgood Marshall, right? But so children are essential to kind of this Black freedom movement as people who are aggrieved by discrimination and racial violence, right? But also as activists and organizing, right? Children were organizing, students were organizing throughout the whole Black freedom movement. Okay. Also, student activists of all ages challenged oppression and other inequalities. The student movement was diverse in demographics with varying motivations, tactics, and causes. And not all African-Americans advocated for integration. Some people advocated for equal resources while maintaining separatism. They advocated for Black determination and power to rule over their own communities, right? So not all African-Americans wanted integration. And in large part, Central, right, was able to get a lot of resources strategically during segregation. So because they didn't want to integrate, the founder of Central kind of used that to get more resources for Central. So getting Central a graduate school early on, right? Using that kind of segregation and racism to help the Black community in this university in particular. Okay? And so North Carolina HBCUs, this are just a logo of all the North Carolina HBCUs. North Carolina houses 11 four-year institutions. At one point, it was the most four-year HBCUs of any state. And one of the reasons why we have so many HBCUs is because there was a significant Black population in North Carolina. And that is tied to what? Slavery, right? So slavery was a major factor in North Carolina. And so there, after slavery, right, there remained a large Black population, right? A lot of this population is kind of centered particularly in the Piedmont region or the middle region of the state. And that's where you find kind of the major urban centers of North Carolina. So you have Charlotte, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, Raleigh, and Durham, all in that kind of Piedmont section. So most of the HBCUs are within that area. In terms of curriculum, early North Carolina HBCUs and HBCUs in general, they were largely more elementary or more focused on literacy kind of thing. Again, going back to slavery, education being denied, education opportunities being denied. But we talked about resistance to that and people still learning how to read and write and utilizing that in different ways. But again, a lot of the kind of initial instruction was to teach people literacy and do more like stuff we associate with K-12 now, that kind of education. These institutions would transform to more higher ed institutions later, depending on the need, right? If we educate people to be literate, right, K-12 kind of education, they need institutions to be further educated. So that's why they kind of became more higher educated focused. For example, esteemed scholar and race leader Anna Julia Cooper attended St. Augustine's Normal and Collegiate Institute for her primary and secondary education, as well as serving briefly as an instructor at the institution. And she's actually one of the first Black women to get a PhD. And she got it, I believe, in Europe. And Mary McLeod Bethune is also a famous race leader who attended primary education in North Carolina HBCUs at Barber Scotia College, right? So a lot of these very important race leaders attended North Carolina HBCUs, okay? Many of the historically Black college universities in North Carolina began with a focus on religious teachings, and often their founders were religious organizations such as the Baptist, Methodist, African-American, Episcopal Zion, and the Presbyterian Church. The second motivating factor for establishing HBCUs in North Carolina was to educate teachers so they could then educate the Black masses. Again, because of discrimination, banning of education and writing, there was the Black mass as a whole. And we already talked about in the South as a whole, there wasn't publicly funded education in the South until Reconstruction. So it's a large population that's not educated. So the focus was on religion, ministers, and also creating teachers so they could educate kind of the primary and secondary education. Okay. Although many of the education institutions for African Americans in North Carolina were founded by white benefactors or funded by white benefactors, African American leadership was essential to the survival of those institutions. As soon as the first classes began to graduate, alumni began teaching at establishing schools throughout North Carolina. So you'll find that a lot of the people that attended the HBCUs in North Carolina were founded early, right? They would go on to found other HBCUs, right? So the alumni of the older HBCUs would found the other HBCUs, like Fayetteville State was founded by alumni of another North Carolina HBCU. So you see, that's why these institutions are connected. Yes, so you'll find that example throughout the history of all HBCUs in North Carolina. So they remain connected. Okay, and so this is just a list of the years that they were founded. And so as you can see, most of these institutions are founded in the 1860s, so shortly after the Civil War, right? So Shaw University, 1865. St. Augustine's University, 1867. Barbara Scotia College, 1867. Johnson C. Smith University, 1867. Fayetteville State University, 1867. Bennett College, 1873. Livingstone College, 1879. Livingston City State University, 1891. North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, 1891. Winston-Salem State University, 1892. And last but not least, North Carolina Central University, 1910, right? And again, a lot of them, except for basically North Carolina Central University, began as primary and secondary institutions. Okay? Okay, so this slide is going to talk about, we talked about the history of HBCUs in North Carolina. This slide gets into the history of activism at HBCUs in North Carolina. So, again, there's an over-focus on 1960 and the A&T4 in particular, and that kind of erases decades of history of activism. And so there were sustained student movements existed at HBCUs during the early to mid-20th century. North Carolina HBCU student activists engaged in multiple successful movements that ranged in participant size and duration prior to the 1960 sit-in movement. Student activists engaged in activism directed internally toward campus administration, faculty, staff, and governing boards, and externally against anti-Black oppression, right? So they were not only just going against anti-Black oppression, right? They were also battling their teachers, their administrators, right? Fighting for instruction, right? In 1931, William Stuart Nelson became the first Black president of Shaw University after students, alumni, faculty, and staff advocated for African-American leadership. So a lot of these early presidents of these institutions were white men. Again, a lot of the benefactors were white men as well. So students in the 1920s at Shaw really advocated for Black leadership, right? And they also experienced repression, right? They experienced suspensions, right? Threats of expulsions, right? So this was happening in the 1920s and 1930s, but they were successful at getting the Black president. From 1937 to 1938, Bennett College and North Carolina A&T students picketed the Carolina Theater for their anti-Blackness. So we've talked a little bit about kind of anti-Black movies, Purdue, Birth of the Nation, those kind of things. And so there were anti-Black depictions in these films, and the students kind of thought to organize against this, right? Also, there was discrimination in seating. In certain theaters, Black people had to sit in certain spaces, right, that were not equal in terms of quality, right? And so in 1937, 1938, some students at A&T and Bennett College got together to organize against this, right? And they were also joined by high school teachers and other faculty members, right? So throughout, we think about campus activism at HBCUs, faculty members are involved. Teachers are involved, students are involved. Also, people who were activists but graduated, right? Alumni activists, right? Are essential to kind of the continuation of this movement work, right? They didn't just forget about their institutions and the people, right? They, when they graduated, they would still work together with current students, right? To do activist work, right? And so we'll find out throughout this lecture, right? That this is happening. And I refer to them as activist alumni. They're not currently students, right? But they have a connection with these institutions, and then they use that connection to have solidarity or collaborate with current students and teachers and faculty members, okay? JC, this is an example of activist alumni. So JCSU, Johnson C. Smith University alumni, and noted activist journalist Trezvant W. Anderson recruited then JCSU undergraduate student leader Reginald A. Hawkins to lead a student group in picketing against the Charlotte Post Office for discriminatory hiring practices in 1943, right? So he attended primary and high school at Johnson C. Smith University in the 1920s, Trezvant Anderson. He then becomes a noted journalist and activist, and he works for the post office, and he experienced discrimination. He also, when he was a student and after he was a student, he would use newspapers, black newspapers, to criticize the administration of JCSU. And sometimes we do it anonymously, right? So it also speaks to the fact that even if you graduate, right, even if you're no longer a part of the university, you still feel a duty to it, right? And a duty to having the best environment and the best people in charge, right? And part of the response of the administration to him criticizing them was to try to repress that kind of criticism, right? So again, part of activism on campus, HBCUs, is activism on campus against administrators, against teachers, right? At the same time, sometimes teachers and administrators and faculty members are collaborators with activists, right? So it's kind of this internal work that's going on. And so Reginald A. Hawkins, who is about 17 at this time, he starts college at 14. But at 17, he's a student leader and activist. He joins the post office picketing in the 1940s, right? And gets other students involved, right? And then in the 1960s, he's going to be a key activist alumni or adult who helps student activists in Charlotte, North Carolina, right? So you see, I said that connection between alumni activists and the current ones. So he would be a key person. Someone, Trezvant Anderson, recruited him, motivated him, and collaborated him. And then later, 20 years later, he would do the same thing for other student activists. The NAACP served as a key organizing structure for North Carolina youth activists prior to the 1960 sit-in movement. Student activists routinely referenced being involved in the NAACP as youth prior to attending college. Also, the NAACP had college chapters throughout the state. By 1955, there were 45 youth council and college chapters in North Carolina, right? So sometimes when we talk about student activism, we like to talk about how the campus space kind of encourages radicalism or encourages them to act, right? But you don't come to campus a blank space, right? Your experiences before you get to campus, right? Your experiences in your communities, right? Your experience with racial discrimination. You may have activists in your family, right? Or in your community kind of shapes what you're doing, right? You don't just become conscious when you go to college, right? So some of these student activists were already kind of oriented to that, right? Some of them weren't, right? And the campus space kind of serves as that kind of movement space that could encourage that kind of work. But I think we have to make room for both of that, right? You come with something, right? You can learn stuff at campus, right? You can join other like-minded people or debate people, right, about strategies and stuff like that. And that serves as a space that kind of motivates movement work, right? And so this is happening. And the NAACP is essential to that, right? Well before the student movement in 1960, they're already doing that youth mobilization on college campuses in North Carolina. Okay? So although sit-ins as a tactic existed before the 1960s, the use and success of it reached a fever pitch in the 1960s. So the first sit-in movement does not happen in 1960, right? Sit-ins had been used as a strategy, right, for decades before that. But it kind of becomes very popular during this time, right? And because of the way the sit-in movement spread in North Carolina, And then throughout the United States, it becomes more of an international thing, right? It's not just one movement, right? It becomes, I mean, it's not just one one moment. It becomes a movement, right? Of dozens of sit-ins as a tactic. So it becomes really popular. And so that's why we associate sit-ins with 1960, in particular in Greensboro. But again, it begins before that. So a sit-in is a civil disobedience tactic during which demonstrators attempt to integrate public facilities and businesses by asking for service and then refusing to leave when denied the service. So the sit-in on February 1st, 1960, by four North Carolina A&T students at a Woolworths in Greensboro, North Carolina, sparked the sit-in movement. Soon thousands, mostly students, followed suit and sit-in demonstrations began throughout the country. Dozens of students at the all-female local historically black university, Bennett College, participated in the movement, including participating in gel-ins, right? So again, when you only focus on the A&T four, right, you ignore all the other A&T two students that participated in it, right? You also ignore the women, the black women who were involved at A&T and at Bennett College, right, who were essential to the successes of the movement. In terms of percentages, Bennett College, even though it was a smaller institution than A&T, had more of a student body participating in the sit-ins than A&T, right?
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
And so you won't kind of know how these movements were successful if you don't take a step back and look at all who were involved, right? These are hundreds and thousands of participants, and if you only focus on the four, and you only focus on that one day that they started, right, you ignore the months and months and months and months it took, right, to ultimately integrate, right? And it also took legal cases, right? They're not just doing boycotts. They're using these different avenues, right, to be successful. But again, if you only focus on that one day, you erase all that. Okay? And speaking to my point, when the sit-in spread in North Carolina, it happens on February 1st, 1960, right? It initially spreads mainly in places that also had HBCUs in North Carolina, right? So it spreads in places that had HBCUs, and it also spreads at places that have significant black high schools, right? So black high schools are also participating in the sit-in movement. And they are kind of the movement space, the integral movement space in the places that don't have a college or university, right? So that's happening. So this is February 1960. By March 1960, you see that has increased, right? The black dots denote places that had sit-in demonstrations and had HBCUs. The two blue ones are places that had historically white institutions, right? And then the red are places that had kind of significant black high school involvement, okay? But again, schools, youth activism is essential to kind of it spreading, right? And then it spreading in North Carolina first leads it to gain momentum to then spread to other states and then spread throughout the country, right? So without it first spreading at HBCUs in North Carolina, you wouldn't have a movement, right? It would just always happen in Greensboro, right? It wouldn't have happened elsewhere, right? Without kind of the other campuses joining in. So again, this is where the HBCUs are. Again, this is the same pattern as the demonstrations. Y'all see that connection? Okay. And I saw, you know, Piedmont right in the middle is where most of the HBCUs are. Except you see Elizabeth City all the way over there and then Fayetteville right there. Okay. So the newspapers were making these connections that, oh, they're spreading at HBCUs, right? One of the earliest places outside of North Carolina that it spread to was Hampton, at Hampton University, right? So again, there's this connection between this movement spreading where places that had HBCUs or significant black high schools, right? And so the newspapers were making these connections, right? These are newspapers that kind of saying, well, it's happening this place in North Carolina, this place in North Carolina, this place in North Carolina, right? Negroes receive victory in North Carolina, right? So they're making these connections between these movements, right? But when we think about, okay, this just happened at A&T or this just happened in Greensboro, right? We ignore the spread of these things, right? And how this also is a way that there can be collaboration, right? And we always talked about with the theater boycott in 1937, 1938, right? Student activists were willing to collaborate with other campuses, right, to do this kind of work. And one of the key newspaper, black newspaper writers and editors in North Carolina, he called for student HBCU students to join together and join and make a larger boycott movement in the 1930s, right? So a lot of people saw the power, right, of HBCUs joining together the campuses to do this kind of movement work, right? And so they saw it in 1937, right? So when it actually happens in 1960, there is this kind of context to it, right? It just doesn't happen out of anywhere. But again, we only focus, usually, the mainstream kind of narrative only focuses on February 1st, 1960, right? And so this is a statue, the February 1st statue. There was criticisms of the statue, particularly about Bennett College activists and their role, right? They're, one of the former faculty of Bennett College, he's like, there ought to be a woman on that statue, right? There are two iconic pictures from the Greensboro sit-in movement, right? It's this one where they make the statue from, and there's another one, well, the sitting down. I showed the other one earlier. Let me see if I can go back to it. This one, right? All these people are not the Greensboro Four, right? These are different men, right? And so even when the iconic photos kind of don't recognize the expansiveness of movements, right? Day two, there are more than four people participating at A&T, right? And by day two, day three, right, Bennett College activists were participating, right? And so again, if you focus only on one day, you ignore what it takes to make a movement successful, right? And the sacrifice it takes, right? So think about college, right? You thinking about going to dances, who you dating, right? You think about hard tests and exams, right? They also were organizing movements, dealing with policing, right? Potentially getting arrested, right? Figuring out, okay, we should have so many people go on this day, or we should have, some people go for 4 hours, then we're gonna have another group come in, right? They had to do carpooling, right? Some students were parents, right? They had to think about childcare, right? Some students were married, right? So when we think of these people as just not people, right? Not humans, not students, right? We ignore all the things they were experiencing, right? Because in the midst of boycotts, they still were thinking about the dances. They still were thinking about dating, right? These things didn't go out the way. Also, some of these student activists were athletes, student athletes, right? And so all these things factor into the movement, right? Some students, their work could have slid by participating. Some students didn't graduate, right, based on their participation, right? And so I said we need to think about kind of those sacrifices made, right, when we think about these movements. Right. And so speaking to that, we should not just focus on 1960. In 1958, Bennett College allowed Martin Luther King Jr. to speak on campus. And this was controversial because initially they wanted to speak at A&T, right? Bennett College is a private institution. A&T is a public institution. And so they experienced government pressure and threats from the KKK and other members to not allow him to speak at A&T. And partially because Bennett is a private school, right? They were allowed, they didn't have the pressures of government resources and things on them. They were able to have MLK kind of speak on their campus, right? And so this happens in 1958. In 1959, so December of 1959, Bennett College in their student newspaper, they post an article that says, "Where do you stand?" And they're really advocating for people to do the work, right? Do something about discrimination and violence we're experiencing, right? Take action, right? And this is happening before February 1st, 1960, right? So one of the controversial moments is that a lot of times with the ANC4, we talk about being spontaneous. Like, we just decided to go and join and do this and do this and do this, right? But a number of those four were participating in NAACP organizations and meetings, right? They had were in strategy sessions before 1960. They were in strategy sessions at Bennett College and with Bennett College students, right? And so some Bennett College students were like, the men went without us, right? So they were planning this, right? This article kind of shows that they were wanting to do direct action, you know, in the student newspaper. They were saying, what are we going to do, right? And then February 1st, 1960, the Greensboro Four, you know, started, right? But you can't erase the strategy sessions that happened before, right, that leads to that, right? And so, again, these are just more newspapers about the participation of Bennett College student activists, right? Shortly after the first sit-in, they decided to form a student organization. And one of the president of Bennett College, she becomes one of the co-leaders of that organization, right? So, again, ANC students at large, Bennett College students are part of the success of the movement. Also, when the movement keeps going on through the summer, what happens that summer? Where do you go? You stay on campus? You go home, right? So youth, Black youth in high school and middle school kind of take up the boycott and demonstrations, right? So again, you have to think about these multiple people that are participating and leading to the success of the movement. Also, students who were homegrown, right? They can stay and keep participating, right? So again, this is a long-term movement, right, that happened. And when you only focus on that first day, you ignore kind of what was necessary to make it successful. And then, so this is more kind of sit-ins. Again, you see the women are involved. They're there, right? So Bennett College participation was essential to it. You had sit-ins and you had picketing, right, that was present. And a lot of times people be like, well, North Carolina is very progressive, right? But they also experienced violence and threats, right? One of the ways that they were protected was the football team came. And it was a little intimidating to people, right? So North Carolina gets this progressive rap, right? That doesn't mean they don't experience violence, right? In the 1950s, there was a cross burning on multiple HBCU campuses. So they are experiencing violence, right? And later in 1960s, civil rights leaders' homes will be bombed in Charlotte, right? So North Carolina has this kind of violence underbelly, right, that we'll talk about later. Okay. And then in 1963, student activism in North Carolina is actually larger than 1960. There's more participants that are participating in the mid-1960s than are participating in 1960, right? And so this picture is a group of Bennett College students being jailed in an old polio hospital. Okay. And so one of the big things is their president, Willoughby Player, which is one of the first Black women presidents of college and universities. She supported them in their activism. She brought them their homework, brought them food, sent telegrams to their parents, right? Because at the same time, administrators and faculty are basically are the parental kind of guidance, right, when you're on campus, right? And so she sent telegrams to say that, you know, I support the students and I'm making sure they're safe and protected, right? So again, administrators are part of this movement work, right? But she also is part of a thing where a white teacher at Bennett College, her husband was tied to leftist radicalism, right? Accused of being a communist, a socialist, right? And that teacher was run out of Bennett College by Dr. Player, right? So it speaks to the fact that administrators can, you know, support activism and movement work and freedom work, right? At the same time, they can restrict it, right? A lot of the times, students at Bennett College in particular, they were rebelling against, they had to wear white gloves and go to Sunday Vesper service and stuff like that, right? So they're restricting some of the constraining policies, right? Not going out at certain hours. And so administrators are containing these multiple roles, right? And Willoughby Player is a great example of the person who does that, right? She's both and, right? Not either or. Okay? But shortly after the 1960 sit-in movement starts in February, Martin Luther King Jr. comes in support. He comes to Durham, North Carolina to support. And they have a meeting at a local church. And part of that meeting, they encourage youth activists and student activists to come together, right, from different campuses, to come together, try to organize together, right? And he also says, he's quoted as saying, fill up the jails, right? So he's encouraging very publicly student activists in North Carolina to keep doing that work, right? But he's also giving the space, right, using the resources of SCLC, right, to help organize students, right, working together, right? So this is happening in February of 1960, right? And this is a picture of them going to a Woolworths in Durham, North Carolina. The student, the person on the right, for your far, y'all's far right, is actually a student, last name Streeter. And so he was a student at Central University at this time. They are accosted, and a journalist, a black journalist, photographer for the local newspaper, the Carolina Times, is arrested and roughed up, right? So this is significant. It speaks to the violence of North Carolina as well, right? So this is happening in February of 1960. And he's Streeter. He's a very important student activist, okay? And so there was that initial kind of February kind of trying to organize student activists of different campuses. But then the person I consider to be one of the key organizers of the civil rights movement, Ella Baker, she comes in and says, we should have a youth organization, right? So Ella Baker, she has integral roles in the NAACP, the SCLC, SNCC, despite battling sexism in these organizations. She was a proponent of grassroots organization or bottom-up leadership. So basically, like, we don't need that one leader at the top, right? We need multiple leaders at the bottom. Everybody can be leaders, right? Grassroots leadership. So she says strong people don't need strong leaders, right? If you're strong yourself, you don't need someone telling you what to do, right? So she wanted to encourage youth, right, to be their own leaders or organize their own organization, right? Not having these adult organizations like NAACP, SCLC telling them what to do. And so she trained and influenced many of the major leaders of the civil rights movement, and she attended Shaw University, right, from 1918 to 1927 for her secondary and collegiate education. So again, activist alumni, right? So this is the kind of form that they sent out to kind of get people to be involved in this youth meeting. They organized a youth leadership meeting at Shaw University in April of 1960. And so she basically says, we'll help provide resources. We want you to send delegates, right? Because we don't need too many people being there so we can actually get work done, right? So send delegates from your communities and campuses. And so this leads to the founding of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, right? And SNCC is an essential part of the civil rights movement and Black Power movement. And so Ella Baker helped establish this. They played a major role in the sit-in movement, Freedom Summer, Freedom Rides, the founding of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, voter registration, and March on Washington. Key leaders were John Lewis, Diane Nash, Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, and Stokely Carmichael, right? They train local people to lead their own movements, which is called participatory democracy, right? So again, they're kind of taking on like Ella Baker's kind of grassroots-led leadership, okay? And so again, this kind of activism throughout the state of North Carolina, HBCU activism, is in larger numbers in the mid-1960s. Right then in 1960, sit-in movement. 500 people are marched in Charlotte area to back the rights bill. And that included students from local kind of institutions like Barbara Scotia College, JCSU, some students from historically white institutions, Livingstone College as well, right, in that kind of Charlotte area. This is an image of boycotts and demonstrations at in Durham at Howard Johnson's. Right. So this is a very large boycott that happened. Hundreds and hundreds of participants participated in this. these are more examples of this larger movement happening in the mid-1960s, right? Of majority student activists, right? So again, larger numbers than in 1960. And then this is a picture of Quentney Baker. Quentney Baker is a significant student activist in North Carolina. He was openly gay. He was a student at North Carolina Central University. He didn't end up getting his degree from North Carolina Central University, but he was a student when he began his activism in 1960. And then he actually trained a lot of the youth activists over the years because he was a part of the NAACP Youth Commandos, which is a smaller group of people who went around North Carolina to train activists on organizing, right? And so he becomes an essential part of kind of North Carolina student activism, and he was openly gay in the 1960s, right? And from Central, right? But have you heard of him? Okay. And he openly was, he participated in the demonstrations in Chapel Hill, and he was injured. His eyes were injured, and he was imprisoned for his activism, right? So that kind of stuff that you think what happens in Mississippi and happens elsewhere happened in North Carolina, right? And then the end of it will be discussing kind of post-1960 activism. So activism continued in North Carolina post-1965 and later in the Black Power movement. There was activism happening. And Sandy Smith is one of the people kind of I focus on, right? So she was from South Carolina, a small town in South Carolina, Piedmont. She came to Bennett College as a student after the uprising in Greensboro. And so let me go to that. So Greensboro uprising happens in May of 1969. Claude Barnes is a student at an all-Black high school. He's radical. He's part of these multiple like Black Power movements and organizations. He wants to be student body president. He was already like junior body president, but he wanted to be senior student body president. The Black administration disallowed him from being a candidate because of his radicalism. The students protested and still voted for him, right? Despite him being disallowed. So their protest continues. The police gets involved and starts attacking and harassing both students and teachers. They run to A&T's campus for support. At A&T's campus, a student organization of Black Unity is kind of being founded. One of the key leaders is Nelson Johnson. And so they run to this local campus to get help. Sobu and Nelson Johnson comes back and goes to support them. They say, you're starting a riot. You're starting this, you're starting that, right? They run back to A&T's campus and a standoff ensues, right? Part of the standoff is a couple of days. Civilians, white civilians, are going around A&T's campus shooting and threatening people who are participating in this uprising. So it happens for days. The mayor and the governors of the state decides to use the National Guard to end the uprising. The National Guard shoots up A&T's campus. They shoot up dormitories that have students in it. This is a picture of bricks with bullets in them from the dormitories. So A&T now has a memorial to Scott's Hall of it. They also brought, you know, helicopters in, right? So this is a time where National Guard is being brought in to end this kind of student-led uprising, right? And we think about Kent State, right? We hear about Kent State, but we don't hear about this kind of violence being used against students and the National Guard being against Black students at HBCUs. This also happens in Orangeburg, South Carolina, right? Kind of government entities using to end and quell student activism, right? And so they end it that way. The students don't get, they're not able to walk in graduation. One student is killed. And to this day, they don't know who killed him. Gregory Steele. I mean, not Gregory Steele. His name is eluding me right now. Part of North Carolina activism is this level of violence and grief, right? That is occurring at this time. And so it is in that Sandy Neely Smith comes into it, right? She is a first year student at Bennett College. This is after the uprising, right? She becomes part of Nelson Johnson and his organization, the Greensboro Association for Poor People. So they're into like fighting eviction, providing food and different resources for Greensboro communities. She joins this group and organization. They become more radical over time. SOBU becomes YOBU, Youth Organization of Black Unity, because they're like, well, not everybody is a student, right? Not everyone is associated with college, universities. We need to expand to other people. They get organizations throughout North Carolina. And Sandy Neely Smith is part of that, right? That organization. Ultimately, in the 1970s, there's a push to kind of consolidate schools. And so they have the Save Our Black Schools movement that Sandy Neely Smith helps lead. And so they end up having thousands of students activists from throughout North Carolina HBCUs joining the streets in Raleigh, right, to protest to save Black HBCUs in North Carolina. And so these are images from that demonstration. They also have events called Black Mondays in their local communities to kind of save Black schools, right? And so she continues to be an activist. She graduates, right? She becomes part of Pan-Africanism, and so does Nelson Johnson. And Nelson Johnson was a veteran of the military, and then he becomes a later student. So he's an older student. And so they become members of the Communist Party, right? They're part of the labor movement in North Carolina, working in factories and textile industries. She works against sexual harassment in these factories, which is very dangerous kind of work, right? At this time, there's a rise in KKK in North Carolina. And in China Grove, which is about close to Charlotte, the KKK decides to do a filming of Birth of a Nation. You know the Birth of a Nation? In 1970s, they do a filming to try to get more members and support. The Communist Workers Party decides to protest that, right? And they almost come into armed conflict with members of the KKK. So in response to this, they decide we're gonna have a Death to the Klan rally in November of 1979 in Greensboro, North Carolina, at a housing project in Greensboro, a predominantly Black area. And they advertise this, they tell the KKK members to come, right? The KKK members and neo-Nazis have a caravan, including in their caravan is a police informant. So they know what's about to happen. They come to the rally and shoot it up, right? And so some of the Communist Workers Party do have guns and shoot back. This is all on the news, so there are videos of this happening. One of the people, five people killed, is Sandy Smith. She's killed trying to save Black children from the middle of the shootout, right? But ultimately, no one is convicted of a crime because they say, well, y'all antagonized the neo-Nazis and KKK members, right? And they weren't attacking you for racial animus. Four to five people killed, the Communist Workers Party, five are white. So it's like, it's not racial animus, right? Even though Sandy Smith is Black woman. And so, they think they may have targeted certain leaders of the movement, including Sandy. So they say it's not racial animus, it's political animus, right? Because you're a communist. This is the reason why this happened. And so no one is convicted. Ultimately, they do a civil case. They're able to win a civil case because one of the members of the Communist Workers Party 5 is not a member of the Communist Workers Party. So they say, well, because you're not a communist, we can't use political animus to justify your killing. Right. So they're able to get some money for that. But ultimately, the people involved keep doing movement work. But when we think about student activism, right, that activism doesn't stop when they stop being students. Right. She remained involved in Greensboro politics. Right. After she graduates. And when she dies, Bennett College students are like, well, why didn't we know her? Right. And so at the end, and years later, they've done like many demonstrations every year. They do demonstrations in Greensboro to remember them, remember Sandy Smith in particular, right? Making that connection. So she's always a Bennett Bell. So Sandy Smith, kind of just the point that I was trying to make, that student activism is a part of like this long legacy of not just the kind of movements we think about, right? Their collaboration kind of continues throughout these years. And there are these other elements involved in terms of violence and sacrifice and loss, right, to do this kind of movement work. And so when we think about student activism in North Carolina, we have to include all these things when we think about that. But thank you. So questions or responses to the lecture. In particular, how do you feel as being a student at HBCU and learning about North Carolina HBCU activism?
I think it's very fascinating, you know, being so, these were students that were in the same buildings, or may not be the same buildings, but the same tables as us. They were students just like us going against the extra work. I think that that shows the commitment they had to changing things for the Black community. So I think it's really fascinating. I think it's really cool.
And it's ordinary people making choices, right? Someone else?
Going based off of what he said, I think it's just really interesting to know that, like, these are our people going, like, the extra mile to do this. And I just feel like now we just don't have that same kind of fight. Like, they was fighting for, like, different things, and, like, they were fighting for what we have now, but there's still, like, plenty of things we could be fighting for. Like, HBCUs don't get the same amount of funding that, like, PWIs get. That's something we could fight for. It's just, like, I feel like we just need to have that same kind of energy that they had.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to movement work, there was never everybody participating. It was always small numbers, right? And depending on who you collaborate with, right? And so there are people doing that work. They just need more numbers and they need more involvement, right? So it's kind of checking in and collaborating with each other to do that kind of, continue that work now. That's a long way.
Also piggybacking up what they said, and so you were saying how these were regular college students, they had other things on their mind and things like that. And I admire the fact that, yes, they were balancing all that, but at the same time, they were in college before technology really took off. So they're doing their homework literally in the library. Like, us as college students, we got information at our fingertips in seconds, and they got to really put in the hours, exactly. So, like, to actually plan all that and have a life and be in a library for hours, it is really inspiring. But also, did you say with the sit-in, when they were arresting people, they took them to a polio hospital?
In the mid-1960s, yeah.
Is that because the jail was too full, or...?
Well, this is before, like, mass incarceration. So a lot of times in these places where these jail ends or kind of people wanting to get arrested, right, they didn't have the space, right? So sometimes people had to be bused to other locations, right, because there's not this mass incarceration that we have now, right? They didn't have the kind of jail space to kind of include all these people.
This is pulling out the famous.
Yes, but I don't think they were where, you know, those people were. But it was just like they used that space as a means to jail these people.
Definitely
going
to be like a retaliation.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, it's still jail, right? it's still jail. So imagine you being in jail at a polio hospital, still having to do homework, and then you got an exam coming up. Or you have a job and now you in jail, right?
I just think it was interesting when they started talking about how there was this whole standoff, like, with the National Guard coming in, because just think about it now. Like, I know we're adults, but it's just like we're still young. We're still youth. We're still kind of kids. And the fact that y'all feel like y'all need to have the government come in, I just feel like it just shows the impact that they were really making. Like, they really felt like they were such a threat that they had to have all these people come in to stop their movement that really didn't end up stopping anything.
Yeah, and then Greensboro, the mayor, justified his actions and said that Black radicals were the reason for the violence and for the conflict. So his actions were justified in bringing the National Guard. Nelson Johnson, the leader, was arrested as well.
You go first.
Okay, cool. When they arrested the students, were they automatically, like, taken out of school? Or, like, were they more lenient because they were, like, HBCUs?
And it depends on the administrator. That's, that's actually a really good question. So it depends on administrators, right? Bennett College, like, Willoughby Player was supportive of student activists and their work, right? So it wouldn't actually be a spoiled for that, right? But there was a group of student teachers from Barbara Scotia College, Nanny Houston, right? She was a student teacher at, I don't want to say a school in Statesville, North Carolina. And so they were participating in boycotts and demonstrations and getting youth involved. And so they were taken out of their school and reprimanded by their administrator at Barbara Scotia College. So he wasn't supportive of their activism and their work. Right? So it depends on the administrator.
I remember somebody had mentioned, appreciated, like, the fight that those students had at that time, and, like, they think about, like, how we are now, and, I just thought that was, like, interesting and a good point, but I also think that it's, like, important to note how, like, their environment kind of spurred their need to resist. They had, like, that sort of, like, direct violence inflicted onto them, and I feel like sometimes nowadays it's harder to see when we're being discriminated against, unless it's, like, legislative or, like, kind of outwardly in our face. And I'm trying to remember the point I was trying to make. I just think it's important to remember, like, the ways in which we were, like, educated as, like, children and stuff. Like, it was very, like, softened and whitewashed. And I was even remembering, like, when we were learning about the civil rights movement, they gave, like, a date range to when it started to end it. And it's, like, when did, like, which black leaders got together and said, yeah, like, we're done,
Sorry
you
now.
Know what I'm saying? Like, so I think it's just, like, a mindset thing. Also mixed in with, like, a lot of people are just, like, I feel like a lot of people, it's hard to, like, reside in, like, find community and resist together because we haven't been taught the tactics to, like, revolution and stuff like that.
Yeah, American ideals are largely individualistic,
exactly.
And that's purposeful, right? And so when you think about, you know, the tactics to resist activism and organizing, right, those adapt, right? So technologies, mass surveillance, mass incarceration, right? They now have the means to jail as many people as they want, right? So when you think about activism and these strategies, right, they have to adapt with the times, right? With the environment that you're in, right? And also the repression efforts, right? So that's also a factor. You're right. That's also a factor.
With the students getting arrested, I'm sure some of them got arrested a lot. Were they racking up a record?
Well, fines, records. Some of them were able to get the records taken away or charges dropped, but some of them charges remained, right? So that does affect jobs, right? A lot of people were blackballed from jobs for participating in student activism. So that affects your kind of career aspirations. And clear point here is one of the members of the Greensboro Four never graduated from ANC. And he also developed alcoholism and died in his, I think, when say his 50s, right? He talked about depression and different experiences and the weight of being an activist and being one of the Greensboro Four. But again, we focus on the Greensboro Four, but we really don't talk about them as people, right? And as kind of sacrificing and losing and the results of the activism they participated in. So just take a closer inspection on, you know, people as people, right? Student activists are people, right?
And do you know if there were misdemeanors or like felonies?
It depends. It varies on state, local, who's charging what, right? It varied. And so the Quinny Baker, he had significant jail time that he got. And there were work camps at that time as well. So he experienced significant jail time. Some people experienced fines, right? So it just depends on the location, what judge they get. It all depends, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Lectures in History podcast. To find even more history content, visit c-span.org/AHTV.